Welcome to VMN Volume 3, Episode 21. The date is September 17th, 2023. VMN is produced and transmitted from unceded Abenaki territory of so-called Vermont. Today we will be talking with Luis Enrique Marquez and Daryl Lamont Jenkins. Luis recently published a book titled Antifascist, a memoir of the Portland Uprising, 2016 to 2020, which was edited by Beth Foster. Antifascist is available for sale at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and many other booksellers. Due to his high profile, Luis attracted the attention of many a far-right grifter and doxer, and has also been the subject of some controversy. Daryl Lamont Jenkins is the executive director of the One People's Project and is often called to discuss politics in many a venue, including national media. Welcome, Daryl and Luis.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great. It's great to see you all. And so, Luis, can you tell us a bit about your book?
Oh, yeah. My book is called Antifascist, a memoir of the Portland Uprising, as you said. And it's just about my experience from 2016 to 2020, what it was like to live here in Portland, Oregon, and fight fascism every day.
So can you give us, who are the main characters in your book? Can you talk about some of them?
Yeah, I'd like the gentleman who wrote my preface, or the preface, as Daryl reminds me that it's always called, not the preface. His name is Tom Tegner. He is one of the oldest sharps in the United States. For those of you that aren't familiar with the word sharps, it stands for skinheads against racial prejudice. He was also involved in the killing of a neo-Nazi here in Portland. I would say he was one of the main characters and an inspiration and a good friend in my life.
For people who don't know, I mean, most people who are ignorant of skinhead history think skinhead, that's a Nazi. Who are these sharps, and where did they come from? And what's the difference between a skinhead and a bonehead?
A bonehead is a Nazi, first of all. A skinhead is never a Nazi, and Nazi can never be a skinhead. Skinheads originated with the immigration of Jamaican citizens to Britain after World War II to help rebuild the country. And when the immigrants from Jamaica came to Britain, they brought their music and their style of dress with them. Rude boys, ska, reggae. And they were moved into the white working class neighborhoods of England. And so then the white kids and the black kids started to mix for the first time. And the white kids started to adopt some of the black styles of dress and their music. And that then they started shaving their heads, and skinhead came from, that's what skinhead comes from. Daryl can speak a lot about that as well as I can.
Excellent. Well, this Nazi, the person who wrote the preface for your book, he killed a Nazi. Now,
No. He did not pull the trigger. He was there and was part of the incident that happened.
Okay. And who was this Nazi? I think he was a member of some notorious band. Is that correct?
Eric Banks. He was the singer of
Bound for Glory.
Bound for Glory. That's right. And he was out here doing Nazi things with another Nazi group here in Portland at that time called Eastside White Pride. And they were terrorizing people.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Eastside White Pride and who they did, and maybe a little bit about Mughaletta Syrah?
Eastside White Pride was a bonehead gang here in Portland in the 80s. They're mostly known for the murder of Mr. Mughaletta Syrah. I believe in 89, 88, 87-ish. He was brutally murdered. He was a father. He was working to be an airline pilot for his son. And he came across these boneheads in the middle of the night, and they severely beat him, murdered him, and drug him down the street, I believe, behind a car.
So it seems like Portland has a long history of Nazi stuff and racism.
Oregon has a huge history. In fact, Oregon was founded as a utopia state for Klan and for white supremacists. So, as much as white supremacy is entrenched in my state, there has always been a group of militant anti-fascists, it seems here, that oppose them.
Understood. As far as the cast of who you were dealing with, can you talk about some of the groups that you ended up standing up against in the streets of Portland?
Sure. Here, we stood up and we still do against Proud Boys. There's Rose City Nationalists, Proud Boys, Three Percenters, and various other white nationalist slash nativist groups. So I mean they've all come to Portland and they've all come under various different names. But the Proud Boys and Three Percenters would probably be the ones that people know the most.
Did Patriot Prayer play a big part of it? Or is that more Seattle?
Excuse me, I didn't hear the first part.
What did Patriot Prayer
Oh.
was they a big part of this or?
They were. I cannot believe that I forgot to mention Patriot Prayer. They're our local homegrown nationalist group. They're actually from Vancouver, Washington. But Vancouver and Portland are 5 minutes away. We're just across the river, so there's a lot of traffic back and forth, but still, Patriot Prayer, they came to Portland a lot, as Daryl knows.
Daryl, you were at some of these demonstrations. Can you talk about how you met Luis and how he got pulled into our orbit here?
Yeah, well, I could tell you I've been at, I think I'm counting two. I went to two of the major rallies that was going on in Portland. I think the one that I went to first was on April 4th. Oh, no, I'm sorry, August 4th, 2019, I want to say. I think that was, and if that wasn't it, I know because I what was it on, Luis?
So you came up first, I believe, for Rock Against Fascism. And
No. I've come up before for other things. Yeah, but when it was a straight up rally, when we
Oh,
was all coming
yeah.
down, yeah, that was August 4th, 2019.
That's
And
right. That was.
that was when there was just like a massive showing of fascists from all over the country. It was pretty much like going to Charlottesville all over
That was
again.
the waterfront event, right?
Yeah, that was the waterfront
Yeah,
event.
that was a
Yeah,
lot.
it was right alongside Portland's waterfront. The only thing that made this different from well, the few things that made this different from Charlottesville was one, no one died, and two, the cops decided to fight for the Nazis. I mean, basically, that's what it just sums up to. I mean, we're used to that. The cops are the ones that actually start putting hands on people. That's what I'm used to at rallies, and this was really no exception. Right after we started chanting, "Who do you protect? Who do you preserve? Who do you protect? Who do you serve?" That's when the tear gas started.
That's when they had
So,
us in those little pins, right? Those little fucking freedom speaking pins.
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yes, I don't even think they put us in pins then. I don't think they put us in pens at this point. I think it was a straight up free for all. But the second one was important too, because that was the one where we all decided that we was just basically going to stay away from the Nazis. I'm stay away from the Proud Boys when they was having their thing, because it was once again supposed to be at the waterfront, but when the city said that they wasn't going to give anybody any protection, they decided to go uptown or somewhere abouts, so that so we pretty much had to run to the place and at the waterfront. But some of us took the trip up to go hassle them, for lack of a better term, at their little where they ended up, which was in the parking lot of an abandoned
Hey, Mark.
Kmart. And that was when stupid happened, because They started shooting their little paintball guns at everybody. They start trying to swing on anyone that was just like within their orbit. They tipped over a van. Me and Luis went to the aftermath of this.
Let me say that Daryl taught me about this trick that he's going to tell you guys about right now. And you should do it.
Okay. What he's referring to is one of the things that whenever you go to wherever Nazis were after they left, is that chances are they might leave something behind. You know, their trash or whatever. So we became the sanitation department. And, you know, we're just looking around, and basically our whole thing was just to see what it looked like. They left a box. That's it. They just left a box laying in the ground. And it was a box with an address on it from Vancouver, Washington. Most of the Nazis pretty much come from Vancouver, Washington, with the name of a guy who was a transphobic activist out of Texas. So our inclination was to believe that he might have moved up into the Portland area after reading that. Or he probably just shipped some stuff up there to a friend's house. In any case, the local Antifa did not have that address. So wherever that box went before it ended up in the parking lot meant that we had somebody's address that didn't want us to have their address. So, I mean, but that's one of the things. One of the reasons why I go out and try to be there whenever these things happen is that you're going to be able to find some information. You're going to be able to gather some clues that you're otherwise not going to get.
And let me say something to that. That day, I remember we were downtown. Two of my compañeros at the time, remember, there were shots downtown fired that day.
Yes, yes. I shouldn't mention that.
I chased a Nazi out of our ranks. It was just staring there with a tattoo. I remember that as well. But out of all of that, and even what ended up happening at 122nd and at that Kmart, the best work of the day was the next day when Daryl took me there. And we found that address. And it wasn't sexy work. And it wasn't like, ooh, look how awesome I am going through trash, but it was the most needed work. And it provided for those of us here in the Northwest an important clue and an important link that we did, as Daryl said, that we didn't know about before. And so now we can all keep an eye on him.
I mean, truth be told, they do Portland has been through the ringer over the past 20 years. Okay. I mean, we just got through talking about Mulligan Sarraw. I mean, maybe 30, almost 30 years. We are talking 30 years because you talk about when Mulligan Sarraw was murdered. That started.
40 years, bro.
Yeah, as I said, 30 years.
Yeah.
So when that happened, that started the first war that went on for a couple of years between fascists and anti-fascists. And that wasn't something that is talked about as much as the second war, the one that Portland just went through. I mean, that wasn't talked about as much as the second war because there was no social media. There was no cameras that gave a damn, no news outlets, but it was just as significant.
So to that, there are Mike Crenshaw, an amazing hip-hop activist who claims Portland as well as Minneapolis from home, wrote a book called It Did Happen Here. Let me go ahead and plug this really, really fast. It's everything that Daryl's talking about in the early days. It is about the first skinhead wars. Tom is also in this book, as well as many amazing local militant anti-fascists in Portland. And if you want to learn about the early days of my city and our struggle, please get this. It is published by PM Press.
and it is amazing. It did happen here, published by PM Press. It's not that expensive, and it's a fucking dope read. Sorry.
And to add to that, there's one another book that I really like. We Go Where They Go, and this you can get from. It's I got this from One People's Project. That's where I ordered this one, and it's by Shannon Clay, Lady Kristen Schwartz, and Vermont's own Michael Staudenmeier, and that's about the history of ARA, which is closely associated with the shark movement.
Absolutely. Like ARA, they're amazing. We learned so much from those people and that came before us. Yeah. And, you know, we as anti-fascists need to learn our history.
Yes. Yes. So getting back to your book, can we talk a little bit more about what you're covering and some, don't give away the whole store, but give some things that'll make people interested in going out and buying your book, or even better, requesting that a local library's get copies so that more than just you can read it.
Absolutely. Well, let's see. So I don't have a writing style. I would say that my writing style is one of trying to like just talk to people. So it's not, there have been so many good books about anti-fascism and the praxis and the philosophy and the overall belief of what it is to be an anti-fascist, because the three of us, we know that's a pretty broad thing, right? From communism to anarchy, right? And everything else in between. So my book's not about that, but what my book's about is what it felt like for me to do these things for the last few years, to be an old man and to re-engage myself politically, and to pick up the fight for the next generation. And it covers everything, starting with Trump's election on November 6, 2016, to Biden's victory. And everything, like my highs, my lows, my mistakes, a few of my successes, and, you know, some of my bigger mistakes. For some of you that don't know, one of my mistakes or controversies would be that I slept with a right winger. I'm not going to call them a fascist because they're not a fascist, but a right winger who, I don't really know where to go from there with that.
Well, you were lonely, and to put it really crudely, was it the small head did the thinking instead of the big head?
I mean, there is some truth in that. Let's, you know, be honest. It was 2021. I was burnt out. I had gotten out of a long-term relationship that should have ended years before it did, with all the stresses of activism. And, I was thinking of my dick. Let's just be honest. And, or I wasn't thinking. There are allegations that came out of that because I didn't hide it, but my private life's always been my private life, right? So I didn't hide it, but I didn't put it forth either. And I think that people freaked out about this relationship with Ara. I had a podcast at one point. She came on my podcast renouncing right wing. The right wing period, but I guess that wasn't enough for people. So there came out allegations that I gave up my comrades and I gave up my friends for getting laid, which isn't the case.
Which I can attest to, because
for those of you that want to assume that of me, I'm going to ask you: you never watched a James Bond movie? Did you ever watch Austin Powers? Just because you're a horny piece of shit doesn't mean that you can't keep to your own praxis. And sometimes getting laid is just about getting laid. Sorry,
Yeah, some
Daryl can attest to it because when Daryl.
Well, let me explain. Because one of the things that he was being accused of, as he said, was that he was giving up people. Well, in that last Portland trip that I took for that rally, the one where ended up in the Kmart, at the Kmart parking lot, the Nazis were looking for me because they knew I was coming into town. And I was staying where I was staying. I met this woman. I said hi and went about my business. She never gave me up, even though she knew that everybody was looking for me. And the thing about it is, she herself has a book. And it's a little ebook that she wrote, and she mentions me in it. And the facts of that encounter did not match the encounter. The fact matched what she had written, I should say. Because he says that I was just all about my left wing political views and all of this. We didn't talk that long. All I said was hi, went into the house.
That's right.
That was the beginning and end of our relationship. And the fact that it went there, the fact that she had to, fact that we weren't I wasn't giving up while I was there, and she doesn't have a lot of information about us as anti-fascists in her book, indicates that she doesn't have any. And if she doesn't have any, then that means at least did not give anyone up. And that, as he pointed out, is an indication that it was all about sex, and he maintained his practice in that regard. It was stupid. I'm not going to deny that.
We should always make fun of it. And our friends do.
But the truth of the matter is, you know, people did get angry because there was a few things beyond that. But look, I'm going to look at it like this. Portland activists were very on edge in this time. So I am not faulting anybody for their reactions or anybody for their reactions. In that time, those who were for or against Luis, I mean, anybody, because everybody seems to be suffering. And I do not mean to make light of this, because it's definitely not my intent. It's not what I'm doing. But when you want to see PTSD in practice, go to Portland and deal with those activists out there, because they've been through the ringer and out the other side like you wouldn't believe for 4 years. People have died.
My friends
in
have
those
died.
4 years. Yes.
My friends, close exactly. friends. Phoenix,
and
Sean.
You go through all of that. And you have we're used to having local governments or politicians, elected officials, whatever, coming down hard on activists. We're used to that. Boy, did they do it this time. And what made it so bad is that it was as if they were defending the Proud Boys. In many respects, because law enforcement seems to have this like symbiotic relationship with them, where shit starts to happen. So, and that's what they had to deal with. And then to add to that nonsense where Donald Trump thought he was going to protect the federal building, by bringing the local, was it National Guard or was it, to attack
immigration secret, like immigration, fuck, what's that team called? I forget. But they're a special service branch of the immigration services. So it's my personal belief, okay, that maybe one or two people got picked up by feds and snatched off the streets. But and I talk about this in my book, but I don't think that necessarily happened. Because here in Portland, we would have seen it on the interwebs, right? We would have seen... My housemate didn't come home last night. My mom was fucking, you know, at the protest and didn't come home. But we didn't see that. But so what I think was happening personally is that the left right now is full of informants and CIs. And I don't care what people say. That's my personal belief. And the way to get those people off the streets and to keep their credibility is to snatch them up. You can then debrief them and then you can release them back. And they may, and they get stronger credibility. What Daryl says to how he has no anger, excuse me, at some of the reactions that people had, I do. And for those people that were close to me that bailed without even talking to me, because here's the thing, I don't know if you know this, but I had a heart attack. As this all comes out, I have a heart attack, right? So I'm in ICU as literally one day I was getting love messages from the nation to get the very same hate messages from those same people. And I published some of those in my book as well. So to those people that were close to me and didn't talk to me, we will never be okay. We'll be anti-fascist. And if I see them getting jumped by fascists, I will jump in because that's my duty. That's my praxis. But we as leftists cannot just assume shit. We have to have a justice system that works. We, you know, anonymous fucking things have fucked up people's lives and in some cases haven't shown to be true. In other cases, they have been shown to be true, right? I was close to that fucking dirtbag anti-fasc for a minute. He conned us all. I brought him into our group, right? I mean, we all make mistakes, but we can't just kill each other. We're just ripping each other apart. And that's one thing that I appreciate about Daryl is that he constantly is reminding me of that. Because I'm pretty reactionary. I don't know if you know this, but I'm kind of emotional at times. A hothead, some might say. Oh, not me, though. And Daryl is always reminding me to calm down, that we're not going to break leftist unity over some he said, she said bullshit. We're going to put our head down and continue doing the work.
And Lord knows we've seen it. Lord knows we've seen it. I mean, when I moved into Philly particularly, there was a lot of drama. This was going back about 10 years ago. It was a lot of like he said, she said stuff that would just destroy groups. But I would say that I still have to maintain that I'm not going to take issue with what's going on in Portland. One of the main what activists in Portland, you can, Louise. Yeah. And the reason why you can is because you live there. I'm 3,000 miles away. Yep. I don't think it's fair to impose impose my outlook on folks who are just going through it. I mean, the crap that was going on, not just now, but even back then, back in the day with the first war, informs me that it's best to listen to folks in Portland about how to approach Portland.
Because people here, where people, when you talk about a war, Daryl, since I'm from here, my friends are from here, I know, like, I have those images, right? Maybe somebody, well, there it is, the chicken. Y'all can't see this, the host has got a chicken in their lap and it's beautiful. But like, you know, places in like, say, Omaha, they don't have wars, or Dallas or fucking, you know, wherever else. Like, we go to war here and people die here and cops
shoot. On both sides, too.
Both sides. Both sides.
Both sides seen casualties.
Yeah. And it's not something that's going away here. And so we're all fucked up here a little bit here in Portland because we don't get a chance to heal.
And that's one of the reasons why this book is so important. Because normally whenever you read anti-fascist books, it's not necessarily somebody who's on the outside looking in. It's usually from folks who have been studying anti-fascism, have been a part of anti-fascist work, and are trying to basically give people a sobering account of what exactly is going on. Luis's book, Anti-Fascist, is about someone who has been in the thick of things, basically telling you how things went down in real time. You know,
to wake up when your house is firebombed.
Yeah, dig that. Dig that. I mean, we talk about what happened. Luis talks about what he was doing as it was happening, because he was there. I mean, like I said, there's just so much when it comes to Portland that we definitely need to take in. I would definitely recommend It Did Happen Here, the book that was just mentioned earlier. But people need to see exactly what happened there just recently. Because we're still dealing with the exception of a few Proud Boys who are now sitting up in prison for about 20 years. We're still dealing with the same people who are still out on the street trying to cause some sort of drama. And this is a nice little blueprint into their asses so that we can handle them. So I would definitely recommend this book. And I'm going to be doing the audio version of it at some point.
Yeah, not probably. But two things that you just remind me of, Greg. Earlier you asked me some of the main characters. And I would honestly say that in the book I do talk about him, but one of the main influences here in Portland would be a gentleman called Sean Keeler, Armenio. Please look him up. Please learn about him. He was the closest thing in Portland that we had to a Fred Hampton, right? We're talking about someone who, when he was 15, wanted to learn anarchist theory in its original language, so he learned to read Italian. This was a person who could shake hands with the right wingers that he met at rallies as he introduced himself, and then fuck them up later when he got to that point. One of the funniest memories I have of Armenio is at an action where we were about 500 yards away from where the Fash were, and Armenio gathered everybody. He's like, okay, we're going to walk over there. We're going to be calm. We're going to hold, you know, we're going to be adults about this. And about 100 yards away, he breaks into a dead run and just like karate kicks his way into the crowded chuds and just flies through, throwing hands all the way out to the other side. Learn about him. He was great. And that's one of the main characters in Portland. Yeah,
I remember I was in Montreal for an anti-fascist concert when he was murdered. And when the news started going down, I went up there and gave everybody the news. We did a moment of silence. And for the rest of the evening, the television screens just had pictures of him.
Right. So and, one of the cool things with my book is that for every copy that is sold, $5 goes into what we're calling the Sean Keeler Anti-Fascist Memorial Fund that Daryl is helping me to administer. And if people need help, we'll eventually have a link on the One People's Project webpage where you can apply and hopefully get some help. But what we did with the first batch of rounds was we were able to give it to Sean's family for his sister to continue with her college education. And I got to tell you, that was such a good feeling. Like, so good. So I want to thank everybody who bought a copy of the book to make that happen. Yeah, that's for sure.
Excellent. So, do you talk at all about some of your more personal antagonists in the right-wing grifter sphere?
Oh
No.
yes, we talk
And
about.
I do mean, and I don't mean he doesn't. I mean, no.
So, I don't want to give anything away, but two, I think that my book has two important parts in it. And ironically enough, I'm not going to say that those are parts that I wrote. Those are parts that anti-fascists did the hard work. Okay? There was an activist here named June Davies. June Davies became compromised because they were reached out to by an officer, Jeffrey Nya, who now works in Spokane, who came to note in the Portland Police Department because he started doing intelligence at Occupy. So he became the big protest cop, right? The guy on shot. So he compromised June, and June gave up lots of information to this cop about where activists were going, what was happening during in real time during actions. And June kept a copy of all these texts. One night, they got drunk with their affinity group and spill the beans and give up all the texts. This affinity group didn't know what to do. They came to me. And we put the text in the book. This was in 2018 when it happened. And the reason we put the conversations in the book were we thought that it was important to see, very rarely do we see actual proof in the left of this person is working with the cops, that person is working with the cops. We hear it all the time. But we very rare, I've never seen proof except for this one time. So I put them in the book because I wanted people to see how the conversation evolved, how the cops manipulate people that are at risk, and how those people can give up information because they feel cared for by this outside source.
Yeah, it's really important to see the psychology of that. One situation I was closer to, it starts back around 2010, 2011. There was a group called Anti-Sec, which was doing a lot of hacking, and one of the groups was called LulzSec. I watched their IRC chat pretty closely, and I knew some people in LulzSec. I've had Jeremy Hammond on my podcast, and he was on in LulzSec. Why do I talk about this? We are talking about leftists turning on each other. The history of LulzSec starts with a group of young, very talented hackers and one social engineer. The social engineer has been tarred and blamed for compromising LulzSec again and again and again, because a reporter named Adrian Chen, who is a security person who helped the cops bust the guy who I believe founded Wired magazine. I can't remember his name. He wrote an article about this person that they talked to the police. If you look at the actual transcript of the court cases, Cebu, Hector Monsegur, was a father, had a daughter that he loved very much. He logged into the LulzSec chat once without using Tor. The cops figured out who he was. They researched him and said, "You'll never see your daughter if you don't cooperate with us." And Hector set up this series of escalating hacks during Occupy, putting a lot of people in jail for a long time, including Jeremy Hammond. The person who's the social engineer is the one who gets blamed for this in leftist circles. I won't stand up entirely for this person because her behavior hasn't been perfect, but it was false that she was the snitch in
you
this
have
case.
To have proof. I mean, even you know what? I've seen leftists throw away other leftists for ridiculous slights, in my opinion. Things that aren't dangerous. Let's look at my case that happened. Slept with Ara because I'm a stupid boy trying to get laid, whatever. Okay, and it got blown up way across the country to people that I don't even fucking know are convinced that I snitched them, right? Here's the thing. If I was in a grown-ass man with a grown-ass history who's been through some shit, I went through so much shit from my own side, why wouldn't I snitch? Right? It's like that movie 300. I don't know if you guys have seen that, right? But that movie 300, it was the bump back guy. He wanted to be part of the Spartans, right? That deformed guy. He wanted to be a Spartan. He wanted to carry a shield and have a cape and be the cool guys. These guys were like, fuck you. You suck. You're broken. And they broke this guy so much that he went over to the Persians and gave up the little goat track. This is how you beat him. We got to stop doing that. We got to have proof. So that's why I put those conversations in my book, right? The other thing that I put in my book is the hard work that anti-fascists did. Here in the Northwest, the Proud Boys became informed a chapter, the Northwest chapter. And they required applications be filled out. That's right. I said applications. Phone numbers, addresses, fucking what level of Proud Boy you're going to be, who saw you do what. One guy, it said he yelled at a cop and he almost punched a cop. Anyway, we put the applications in the book because, as Daryl said earlier, leadership, national leadership went to jail. Not your local everyday Proud Boy is still out and about. That's still, excuse me, a member and still cares and carries the beliefs. The worker bees, shall we say. So we expose all those worker bees. We had someone who became a Proud Boy, who wasn't a Proud Boy, and got their hands on the applications for us, gave them to a comrade who then gave them to me, and I gave them to other people, and we put them in the book. So those are there, and phone numbers are blocked out, area codes are blocked out, so do what you will. I am not endorsing or telling you to do anything, but if you're smart, you can do math. So those are the two most important parts of the book, I think.
Very cool. And so can you talk a little bit about your antagonist? We just went, we just talked a little bit about him.
Oh, yeah.
Him in on surface. I actually did a podcast with Lauren Regan where we discussed the Andy Ngo trial, about how basically John Hacker even admitted to pouring water on him, and basically the jury still found against him. Can you talk about what it's been like? I mean, this household's been attacked by said clown too, but you're closer, and he's been focused on Portland and on you. What has the effect been with this?
So Andy doesn't like me. He got mad at me personally on my old podcast. I did a couple of bits of Andy Ngo. One where his mom was diddling him. One where he went to the concentration camp and I chopped him up and then made him into stew for the people at the concentration camps. And then what was the other one? Oh yeah, I did a cooking show on how to cook Andy Ngo, that you can't cook him in a wok because that's racist, but you can cook him with bangers and mash. Tasty. So Andy doesn't like
me. I just work here.
Huh?
I just work here.
And so I thought they were pretty funny. Andy didn't think they were funny. In fact, Andy wrote a best-selling book, mentioned me, and there is not one bit of truth in his book about anti-fascism, right?
We have to Blake here. I'm just the host. I can't claim to approve of all your bits.
Absolutely. No, I like, again, as I say in every media appearance, I speak for myself only. But if you do get a chance to listen to Andy's mom diddling him, it is fucking hysterically funny. I gotta say. Because it's like, oh, mommy, no. Oh, mommy, no. Oh, mommy. Oh, mommy. But I don't want to give it away.
Now, I'm not doing that part in the audiobook.
Okay. Yeah. It's not, that part's not in the audiobook, by the way.
Good.
So Andy thought that for some reason I was a member of Rose City Antifa. I don't know if this group exists. I don't know anything about any group called Rose City Antifa, but he thought I was the president. So he tried suing me on behalf of Rose City Antifa, saying that since I'm the president, I can be sued because Rose City Antifa was part of the people that milkshaked him. Milkshake? Milkshook. Anyway. And I had to go to court and fight myself off of that case, which I successfully did because I could prove that I'm not part of any group called Rose City Antifa. The other defendants, I got to say here, much kudos to the two defendants that went and fought and won. All right. One of those was a mother of two, a single mother of two. And the other one is as the self-proclaimed John. Much, much love to you guys and congratulations on the victory. Now, there are three other people that had judgments found against them because they did not show up. Two of those people were served alternatively, which means their cases came, they found out that the court doesn't have to give you paperwork saying that you have a trial or anything, that they can just put ads in papers in the newspaper. And that's something that the state has been using to screw houseless people over for years. And these people were found, you know, to be in default. They owe Andy $100K each. I believe they have fundraisers, and can use your support if you want, support them. Just please remember that right now, as far as my opinion goes, that money goes to support Andy's lifestyle. And we have people that are striking right now for the working man. The UAW strike just started, the Writers Guild, the Actors Strike. Here in Portland, we're going to have a teacher strike. So there are lots of people that could use your help. But Andy's a dick. I wrote about him in my book, but not by name, but you'll be able to see him. Another one of my so-called antagonists, I would say, is Joey Stalin Gibson, who told me he couldn't be fascist because he was Japanese. All I want to say there is that they have no history with fascism, so maybe he's right. But Joey called me a pedophile and a rapist about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, on one of his videos. So I launched a lawsuit against him for defamation. And he just kept dragging it out and dragging it out and dragging it out. And I thought we were going to go to court to trial this year, but he was going to drag it out for two more years. So I just settled, which means that he had to apologize for calling me those things that I'm not and give me an undisclosed sum of money that I was then able to pass along to other anti-fascists and help them do some things. So Joey lost, Andy lost. Patriot Prayer has snuck people onto my jury and still lost. Like that's like they're so inadequate. These guys, like, they just like to lose. Like, I mean, you know, they just really enjoy losing. but I think they're going to organize again.
So Portland is a really liberal city. Can you talk about what it's like to live under this kind of progressive government and this progressive police department?
It's a joy. It, progressive and liberals are so wonderful. It's actually really funny. I went to go see John Oliver the other week, and he brought up a joke about like Florida, and all these Portland liberals were like, "Boo, Florida!" Like somehow we're better, right? As I said earlier, we are a state that's founded as a utopia for white supremacy. So white supremacy is still in place here. For example, I live in a bar district in one of the little hip sections of Portland, okay? One of the liberal, wealthy hip sections, so my kid could go to school here. There is a bar here, and it's a hip-hop bar, and it just opened up, and all these liberals in my neighborhood at their local watering establishments have been like, "Have you noticed the types of people that are coming to the neighborhood since that bar has opened up?" And it's like, what, black kids? Because that's what it is. So that's what it's like to live under a liberal government. It's just as racist, but it's racism with a smile. And if you want to know about our police force and the fucking brutality of it, Robert Evans has a really good podcast called Behind the Police, where he talks about our rapid response team doing lines of cocaine and then putting on armor and jumping on the backs of cars and going for drug busts. I mean, that's our police force here, right? Our police force is quick to shoot. We saw it for the last 4 years. They constantly defended Patriot Prayer right-wing groups with guns, might I add. That, like, these guys were carrying guns and they defended them against unarmed, black-masked human beings with no weapons.
So, I hear from the right wing that Portland was burnt down to the ground. How long did it take to rebuild all the buildings?
We're still smoldering here. We haven't recovered. We're FEMA has not come yet. If you can hear the helicopter in the background, hopefully that is a mobile aerial hospital coming in place because we need them here. We've run out of electricity and water. No toilet paper. You know, during COVID, when everybody was buying toilet paper, I really wanted to go TP a right winger's house because I was just like, that would be such a flex move right now, right? Just cover their house in toilet paper, be like, we give no shits. But Daryl wasn't for the idea.
Yes. Well, in my case, I tried to, believe it or not, stay under the radar in the things that I do. So that wasn't the worst for me.
You're staying under the radar? What are you talking about? People call you. People call Daryl when they're bored because they sit at home and they go, "Oh, I think I'm going to be an Aryan Nation shot caller today." Okay. And then they call you up and they're like, "Yeah, I'm an Aryan Nation shot caller. Fuck it. Blah, 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 blah." And you
yeah, but then, but then you see, oh yeah, yeah. But like I said, I fly under the radar, so they have to call me. What I mean by flying under the radar is that when they call me, this phone starts recording.
Oh my God, that was the greatest conversation ever. Like, this guy once called Daryl, and Daryl's like, "Here, you gotta listen to this." And it scared me at first because he was all like, "I'm Aryan Nations. We put a hit out on Luis because Luis ratted out some Aryan Nation dude back in the guy's like, what the fuck?" That's good times. See,
the one of the important things about how I've approached things is that, you know, I'm older. I'm 55 years old, so I'm not actually gonna be jumping into the mix the way I used to back in the day. One of the most important things about me is just I've always played it cool. And I let the other side just hang themselves. I just provide the rope.
I appreciate that so much of you. Like, I've seen cats just in your face and I'm just like, hit them, Fucking just real quick, bap, dude. Just fucking just bap. And you just so calm and just talk to
because,
them.
Because the thing is, I'm not going to deal with it in when you know, it's kind of like, I know how I'm going to handle this. I'll get them later. I learned that from my father. My father would get ganged up when he was a kid. When he was a kid, when he was a teenager. I mean, come on, my father's from North, so.
But you're so humble, man, and like I appreciate that about you.
Yeah, so, but I'm so humble. But I'm so humble. But look at all the locks on their side that I've destroyed.
Right, but seriously, what I mean is like, okay, so case in point, we're at Punk Rock Bowling this last year, right? And
in Vegas, Punk Rock Bowling is a festival. That's actually worth going to. So
right, and we'll be there again next year. But like, first of all, we took a gangster ass picture. Me and some of the boys from Portland here and Daryl, like with Vegas right behind us on this rooftop at night. So anyway, we went to go see Fishbone that night. And the cool thing about Punk Rock Bowling is that they offer club shows. So not only like the big festival daytime with thousands of people, right? But you get a chance to see some of the bands that you really want to see up close and personal. So we see Fishbone with like maybe 1,000 other people, right? Maybe that. And we're backstage and we're chatting up and stuff. And Daryl is kind of like, he's there. And we meet Fishbone and like, Daryl's just like, he's just fanboy. I'm like, dude, he's got a Netflix movie. You need to see his Netflix movie. Like, that's how humble of a guy you are, bro. You won't even toot your own horn like that. I appreciate that about you, but sometimes your horn needs to be tooted, bro. You know? Because you got a superhero playing you. Who can say that?
And I was wearing his shirt.
Right? Right? And so if y'all get a chance next year, go to Punk Rock Bowling because you can drink in Vegas anywhere. It's lots of fun.
And hopefully I'll have the booth that One People's Project was supposed to have at that time. But
and you'll be able to get my book there too, and t-shirts and stuff like that. You'll have a booth there. And then just come. But it's hot, so be aware of that.
Be very aware of that. Holy shit.
And how you could sit in those bleachers, bro. Daryl decided to sit
here. Because I'm 55 and 375 pounds. I had to sit.
Sit in the bleachers in the hottest part. Which like they, and for some reason, the promoters at Punk Rock Bowling were like, let's have metal bleachers because those are a good idea with the sun and no yawning over them. Let's just do that. Who was your favorite band you saw there?
My favorite band, Fishbone. Yeah. You know, without a shadow of a doubt, there was a band, their band that I've been wanting to see for a very long time. I've seen Bad Religion twice before. There was a lot of good, I mean, I was glad to see Ended. Ended was a band from out of Maryland, I think Baltimore. They're a hardcore band that was that actually played a show for One People's Project benefit back in January. That actually got attacked by Nazis.
What happened to that Nazi, by the way?
He's still sitting in jail now. He's supposed to be in court. His name is Nicholas Mucci. He's supposed to be in court on October 6th.
What did he go to jail for?
He went to the show that he thought he was going to shut down, I'm assuming, and started screaming White Lives Matter, hence the name of his group. And smoked bomb everybody outside. And then he came back about an hour later and thought he was going to pepper spray people. And then he jumped in his car and sped off. Now, no one was really interested in calling the police, but because this was being held in a particular church, the church called the police. So they got the video surveillance and they got the remnants of the smoke bomb, which had the brand name on it, which was actually the name of the shop that he had bought the smoke bombs at. And whenever you buy smoke bombs and other sort of fireworks in this area, you have to provide ID, which was on record when the cops went there to get get information from the store. So when White Lives Matter was holding a rally in March, after they were done, the police just walked up to Mucci and said, "Come with us." And that was the beginning of that, end of that. Incidentally, he had purchased those smoke bombs in October, just the day before Gavin McGinnis, the founder of the Proud Boys, and this troll named Alex Stein tried to hold an event that we eventually shut down, rather they eventually shut down, at Penn State University. And there was some pepper spraying going on, and it was courtesy of, we found out later, Nicholas Mucci and another guy named Claudino Petruccelli, who got busted himself for trying to post White Lives Matter stickers around here in Jersey. So yeah, Jersey was responsible for what happened in Penn State. And but see, this is the kind of thing that we deal with. You know, I mean, this isn't the first time that I've had problems with people trying to attack the show. Nazis trying to attack our shows. Hell, Australia just had to deal with it. Melbourne, Australia just had to deal with Nazis thinking they were going to go to an anti-fascist show with knives. But you have
200. They stood up.
That was one of the dumbest moves in the world. They thought that there was a couple of, I think it was a dozen or two dozen of Nazis and about 200-300 anti-fascists. You lost. You lost.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the thing though here that bothers me is that the right uses people of color. And then people of color get set up, right? Because, like, I mean, that's what happens is, like, people that are oppressing others find the oppressed to use on their behalf, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, like, Tiny's in jail. Tario's in jail. Both of those guys are in jail for long periods of time.
Tiny, yeah. Tario, let's hold off on the people of color thing on him.
But wait, here's what I'm saying. They're pieces of shit, and they can't play that card anymore, that person of color card anymore, okay? But, A, if we're all abolitionists, we shouldn't be celebrating the fact that they're going to jail. And, B, we did, like, there's nothing to celebrate because we caught some puppets, bro.
Yeah. The Proud Boys were always due to be the fall guys. They were always due to be the fall guys. And no, it's not so much that you celebrate the fact that the system is locking up people of color. I mean, that goes without saying that we are not down with that. Having said that, we do enjoy the fact that there are some problems happening to some fascists, even if it is some token problems. But we do appreciate seeing it from time to time. And incidentally, the reason why I said hold off on Enrique Tarrio calling him a person of color is because every time I see him, when he's not in the field, when he's not in the street, he's about as white as your grand wizard. You know, I mean, I sat in the courtroom while he was being sentenced. He came out. I'm used to seeing the dude dark. Mm-hmm. I'm used to seeing the dude dark. This dude was whiter than white. And then I look at his family who came up to testify on his behalf. White women.
Cubano, right?
No.
Yes, Cubano?
Yes, he is. But he keeps calling himself an Afro-Cuban. But then you look at the Bureau of Prisons record on him. Race, white.
Well, yeah, because here's
the thing. And they've done that twice.
His family left Cuba when fucking Batista fucking got overthrown. So here's the thing. All those Cubanos that fucking were bitching about Castro and stuff, they were all fucking right-wing, fascist types of people that were oppressing the poor and the uneducated of Cuba. So fuck those guys in the first place.
Well, yeah, right? True. Like, but my concern is in the case of Tario or Henry Tario. His mother said to call him Henry while he was testifying. But the thing is, I'm wondering just how Afro-Cuban he is, because everything that I have seen in the past couple of years indicates that he is a white man. And
it sounds like he's about as Afro-Cuban as Andy Ngo is English, is what you're saying.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. Pretty much. So, I mean,
so he's another one that you can't eat with rice and beans, but it sounds like bangers and mash you can eat them with.
Yes. Okay. Oh, brother.
So Tario, a lot of people don't know this. Tario is Spanish for white guy. A lot of people don't know that, I guess.
I'm going to look that up. Yes.
It's just like in Vietnamese, no means English. I don't make the rules, guys.
Yeah, it's not just people of color that get used as tools. One of the Oath Keepers, Jessica Watkins, that's a trans woman who got sucked into this right wing stuff. I mean,
I understand that. Like, I really don't understand. Like, LGBTQIA right wingers.
I understand it. I understand it completely. Yeah, they may be of a depressed people, a depressed class. They may be targeted regularly by the right. But when you come into your own, when you actually are raised in a life, in a world that you don't see the kinds of oppression and hard times that maybe people in the past have had, that's within your culture and your heritage, then you tend to think that everything's good and you become a conservative. Let's face it, a lot of communities of color are conservative within themselves.
Yeah.
But when now we're living in an era where you don't have to be within yourself, which means that conservatism comes with you into the mainstream. That means you're going to have some folks that take it even further. They take it even further and say, okay, conservatism means I can be a full-on fascist, which is what they end up becoming. Now, what that generally means is that you're going to have some fascists, full-on fascists, that say, we'll work with it for now. We'll use it. It will help. Yeah, how can you call us racist when our leader is Afro-Cuban?
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Now we got a really weird answer to that now. So, but, you know.
I mean, when I was at Charlottesville, one of the people I filmed with that really weird little camera that I have was a trans woman who was on the fash side. I asked her how she found out about the rally, and she said, well, I found it out about on Stormfront. Back in the 90s, there was a BBS, you know, that you had to dial into, and for trans people. And that the part of that BBS was white supremacists. And I think she might have been one of the people behind that. And that person who was the Oath Keeper, she didn't have an easy life. She got kicked. She grew up in a very fundamentalist family. They abused the hell out of her. She went in the military, got kicked out for being LGBT, had some bad times. And then she ended up getting a bar out in Woodstock, Ohio, and started listening to Alex Jones. And from Alex Jones, she was off to the races. She believed all of it. And she became an Oath Keeper and J6.
You know, it's really almost heartbreaking that, like, if we as leftists use as much compassion as we say that we have or practice it or try, myself included, like, how many people would just remain leftists? Yeah, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like people forget, like, Benito Mussolini is named after one of the most famous Mexican leftists, Benito. You know, and he used to be a leftist. I mean, yeah, it's different for him. Like, I'm not trying, like, he, you know, whatever. He's, but you know what I'm saying? It's like, we can if we actually had love and kindness for each other and respect and justice, we could save ourselves a whole lot of issues and maybe even win.
We'll win. We will win.
In our lifetime, bro.
We will win in our lifetime. We're just going to lose a whole lot of people if we don't start getting our act together.
But here's the thing. I think everyone right now in this podcast is over the age of 50. Okay? And, like, we, as olders, we really only have one or two couple battles left, really, where we can go partake. And I want to partake. Right? Like I want to, like, win or lose, I want to be throwing blows. So, which brings us to an interesting question. Let me ask you guys this. If Donald Trump being elected was a guarantee, and if by him being elected, like, we would get our shit together as leftists and overthrow everything, would you be for it? Like, are you guys kind of an accelerationist?
No. And people ask that of me before. It's like, the one thing that would be great about Donald Trump winning, this was in 2016, is that it will accelerate the revolution. How's that going? I mean, yeah, it's good that people are being a lot more aware about fascism to the point that it's not just a buzzword. But by the same token, do you really want to win and lose so much at the same time? I mean, it's not, we know better now. This is one of the things I had said when I was on one of the mainstream shows. It says, stop waiting for people to die. Because it's like in Charlottesville, we saw Heather Heyer get murdered. And that's when everybody said, okay, we got to do something about white supremacy. They quieted down on that. And then January 6th happened and said, okay, we got to do something about January 6th because somebody died. A few people died in that, you know, and it's like, we know how to handle things now. We know better than to let things happen. And yet we do. We got to stop doing that. Take the bull by the horns and handle things in peacetime, because honestly, it's already too late whenever a crisis happens. Donald Trump should not be allowed to go any further than he already has, and it's bad enough that he has gone this far. Because right behind Donald Trump are people who know what they're doing. I mean, that was one of the things we had to deal with when it came to Hitler. Hitler was a Donald Trump in the sense that he wasn't really the smartest one in the room. But the smartest one in the room wanted him out of the way so that they can do some really dangerous crap. And luckily, we was able to break Germans before the Nazis, before they was able to have real power. But the truth of the matter is, here we are again. We know better now. We handle this now. Well, I don't want to see anybody ever try to tell me that we got to have a revolution. We need people like the worst of the worst in power so that we can motivate everybody to do something. You might already be too late.
I mean, here's the thing, though, that I worry about is, unfortunately, a lot of leftists don't watch sports. And before I get crucified here, what I mean with that is, like, they don't play sports. I'm a gang member. And what I mean by that is, like, I'm a born gang member. Like I've never been a solo type person. You feel what I'm saying? Like I've always played team sports. I've always hung out with, like, a group of friends. I'm a gang member by my own definition. And so, but the thing that I've learned by being a gang member, a teammate, is, like, especially on a football team, is that there are 11 people on a side. And you don't have to like that person to the left or right of you, but you have to give it your best when you're playing. You all have to buy into the same idea. And I'm worried that that's not going to happen to the left.
I mean, I, I'm talking about sports, I'm a lifter. If you want to lift your heavy weights, you have three phases. You have you build your platform, which is a lot of reps. You build your muscle. Then you start to sharpen things where you're going a little heavier. Just as your meat is coming up, you sharpen things. Now for the left, you can't get rid of that building your base thing, which is building relationships with people, organizing, having the trust between your people. That's building your base to build your strength. If you go and try to lift the heaviest weight possible without building your base or sharpening, you're going to tear your muscles off your tendons, off your bones. It's the same thing with building a movement. You got to build your base, and that might be having a breakfast program where you do like the Black Panthers did, and you serve breakfast to your community, and you get people to learn to be there and to be solid about that. And you have then sharpening it. Maybe we have an event where we get a little rowdy. We have to yell at a school board meeting. We have to be tough. When it comes down to we have to actually fight for our life, we can't do that if we don't have comrades that we built our base with.
You know, I think that's interesting. And what you just said, like, yeah, we have to start going to school board meetings, because, like, I think it's really interesting that that's, you know, a specific area that the right wing has targeted. And they are persistent with showing up at school board meetings, whether they have kids or they don't have kids, you know, and we need to do the same thing, especially, you know, for the next generation. Yeah. Daryl, what do you think about that?
I've already said it.
It sounds like we're gonna have to wrap up pretty soon, because Daryl's gotta leave pretty soon. But before we wrap up this wonderful conversation, I want everyone here to plug what they're doing. I will start as the host. We will be having a fundraiser in Barre, Vermont on September 30th in the evening for Epona Rose. Epona Rose is a trans woman who, basically, it was a country song. Everything went wrong. Her car broke down. Her friends that were driving with her flaked off, and she ended up pitching into Flagstaff. And some people basically jumped her at a where she was hanging out, waiting to meet people. And she defended herself, and now she's charged with assaulting a gang of men against this skinny little trans woman. So freeoponarose.org, support her. If you're in Vermont or if you're in the area, come to the Old Labor Hall. We're going to have a punk show, and some of it's going to be punk and some of it's going to be folk, because it's Vermont, but show up at that. And if you can't do that, try to throw some money at freeeponarose.org. Next.
Well, I could tell you, you can always find me at onepeoplesproject.com or a bunch of social media outlets under the name D. Lamont Jenkins, namely Threads and Instagram. Yes, you can still find me on Twitter, but I'm kind of like trying not to do as much on Twitter as I used to. So I'm using Threads, I'm using Instagram, I'm on TikTok as the Notorious DLJ. Sorry. And incidentally, there are there's another book we haven't brought up yet, and it's No Pasaran. Woo-hoo. And Anti-Fascist Dispatches from a World in Crisis. This book, I actually have an essay in, but it's a series of essays from anti-fascists from all over, and it is edited by Shane Burley, Portland's own, and it's put out by AK Press. We Go Where They Go is PM Press. So yeah, No Pasaran.
I thought that was a PM Press book too. AK, huh?
No, it's AK.
Nice. Oh.
And see, we were talking earlier, let's try to get all these books in our libraries. I go to my local library, and they don't have this book. But they have Andy Noseberg, who, by the way, also mentions me.
I'm on page one, paragraph three. Beat that.
I'm on, I don't know what page I'm on. I'm looking for, I'm waiting for it, waiting to see it in the bargain bin so I can just go ahead and snatch it up.
It's there. It's been there.
Before, while we're talking about books, there's another book that you probably haven't seen. This is called Facing Towards the Dawn, The Italian Anarchist of New London. It's an academic book, but it's about how the working class community of New London, Connecticut, was deeply anarchist, and how these people were fleeing from repression in Italy and elsewhere and came to settle in New London, Connecticut. And it's an absolutely wonderful book, and I don't think very many people know about it. The person who sent this to me is a dear friend. Her mother has an interesting history. I can't give names because of confidentiality, but when Donald Trump was elected president, what she said was, "I didn't shoot enough fascists in Spain."
That's awesome. Okay, I guess it's my turn now. So you can find me on Twitter and I guess Threads. I don't really use it though. And Instagram at Luis the Leftist. My book, what's it called? Oh yeah, Anti-Fascist, Memoir of the Portland Uprising 2016 to 2020. You can order it at antifascistmemoir.com. And then I'll be with Daryl, hopefully talking and traveling next year. So you can find us there. Or Punk Rock Bullying at his booth. Come buy his stuff and come buy my book and say hi. And come say hi to Marina because they'll be there too.
All right.
All right. I will read us out then. If you like this podcast, please consider sharing and liking it on your social media. Reviews help drive the algorithms that basically run the internet world. So please, if you have the time, leave a review on your podcast aggregator. Reviews on Apple and Google help a lot. So if, and only if, you are willing to deal with these companies, leave reviews. This was VMN Volume 3, Episode 21. VMN was formerly known as Vermont Movement News and can be found on podcast apps as Vermont Movement News. Thank you very much.